stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to the Friday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic listeners. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, why deal with all that over the weekend? Let's get those questions answered today. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. Once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email. You can do that 24/7. ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. Ace McKay, our producer today. Rich Jesse screening the phones. Vanessa Sanchez handling social media. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box. We will take it from there. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. Ready for the weekend, are you?
Always.
Something exciting going on, perhaps?
Domestics.
Running the numbers.
It's always domestics.
You'll live longer, I think. Yeah. We're going to lead off with a question from Zenith. What a great name for somebody who likes old radios. Zenith. Just like the quality goes in before the name goes on.
There you go.
All right. Zenith says, what does it mean to be Eastern Orthodox?
Thanks. I appreciate the question. So the church is 2,000 years old, and when the apostles went out to the four corners of the world, they obviously landed in different areas, different cultures, different languages, different ethnicities, and so the embellishments that grew up around the practice of the Christian faith and liturgy took slightly different forms in different places in the world. One thing that the Catholic Church had in common across those cultures was the institution of apostolic succession and the sacraments. But there are variations in the way those truths are lived out. And so even theological traditions can take on subtly and sometimes not so subtle differences in the way that the gospel is expressed in different cultures. And so basically, you can distinguish sort of two main families, and this is somewhat arbitrary, but two main families of Christian churches according to cultural differences, and we basically can characterize East and West, Latin and Greek. That's a simplification because there's a lot more going on in the West than Latin, and there's a lot more going on in the East than Greek. But that's often the way it's referred to. In the 11th century, the sort of cultural and political differences between East and West and the way they lived the faith eventuated in a formal split in the Catholic Church between the eastern half of the church and the western half of the church. And the way we refer to the eastern part of the church that separated from the Church of Rome and from obedience to the Pope is by referring to them as Eastern Orthodox.
Okay. Well, there you go. Now, you know, Zenith, thanks so much for your email. Johnny sent us this one. What is the correct Bible to use as a Catholic, and which one do you prefer, Dr. Anders?
Right. So it's kind of like the best way of cooking your vegetables, the way that gets you to eat the most of them, you know? So,
yeah.
I personally use the New Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition.
Okay.
But in saying that, I have to qualify, you know, whenever I study Scripture, I don't just limit myself to a translation. I mean, I look at lots of translations. I look at the original Greek and Hebrew. I read commentaries, you know. But I like the New Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition.
Is there a correct Bible per se for Catholics to use? A correct Bible?
Well, there is a canonical list of books that belong in the Catholic Bible, and you won't find that duplicated in non-Catholic Bibles, right? In liturgy in North America, we use the New American Bible, um, but uh, But, you know, I think the USCCB maintains, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops maintains a list of biblical translations that can be used in liturgy. That would mean they have the church's approval.
All right.
But there's no mandated, you have to read this translation.
Okay. Very good. And Johnny, thanks so much for your email. Lines are filling up here at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Roman says, I play a video game that has elements of magic in it. Is it permissible to play this game as a Catholic?
Yes, it's permissible to play the game that has elements of magic in it as a Catholic. You know, if you find that playing your magical video game leads you to strongly desire to practice sorcery in real life, then I would advise against it. You know?
Yeah.
But you know, this is fantasy and play, and yes, that's fine.
Okay. Roman, thanks so much for your email. This one from Madison. Where did Elijah and Isaiah go?
Well, Isaiah died, and he would have gone to the Limbus of the Fathers. You know, the exact state of Elijah is a little bit controversial. He gets caught up to heaven in a fiery chariot. Now, what exactly happens after that is a little bit hard to determine. Mm. But in terms of his ultimate destiny, Isaiah is a saint of the Catholic Church. In fact, there are churches named after Saint Elijah or Saint Elias, as he's sometimes known in the East.
Yes. All right. And here's a quick one here as we're going to break from Michael. What is the best way to argue faith and works with a Protestant?
I could do that all afternoon. Basically, I think personally that the way Protestants construe the question radically misunderstands what the Bible means when it talks about salvation is by grace and not by works. Because in the context in which Paul uses that language, mm-hmm. he makes it pretty clear, seems to me, that the works he has in mind are the things that distinguish Jews from Gentiles. So basically elements of the Mosaic Code. And no Catholic thinks that you are declared righteous before God by adhering to the Mosaic Code, right? But the Protestants mean more than that. They typically think works includes any kind of moral striving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly not what Paul has in mind. Paul says explicitly that we're declared righteous before God for obeying the precepts of the law. And that he means here, you know, the sort of inner core of the thing, the love of God and neighbor and the virtues. And he tells us that that is accomplished through the power of the Holy Spirit that comes by faith. So there's a lot more I could say on the topic, but here comes the bell.
Off we go. Michael, thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we will talk with Jeff in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Also, David in Peoria. Lines are open for you, too. 833-288-EWTN. 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion on EWTN. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. We are 3 and 3. We've got 3 lines busy and 3 lines available for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Have something wonderful for you. It is absolutely free from EWTN. You can journey through salvation history and discover the profound story of God's relentless love for us. We have a complimentary copy of The 12 Stations of the Most Holy Eucharist for you. This free ebook will illuminate the incredible gift of the Eucharist like never before. Download your complimentary copy of The 12 Stations of the Most Holy Eucharist. Get it by going to EWTN.com/Catholicism. Don't miss this opportunity to enrich your faith. Again, the address EWTN.com/Catholicism. Look there for the 12 Stations of the Most Holy Eucharist. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning today with Jeff in Ann Arbor, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Hello, Jeff. Happy Friday. What's on your mind today?
Hey. Hi, Dr. Anders. I'd like to just ask a question. I believe that, according to my understanding, that the church was founded through Peter, you will build a rock upon this church upon you. And the problem I'm having is that, and I'm a little nervous saying just speaking about this, but the Pope is supposed to be a vicar of Christ and infallible. And in my 100% belief that I believe that no man is infallible, and I don't believe only one person can be a vicar of Christ. It disallows me from being part of the Catholic Church, and it utterly breaks my heart. And I wonder if you could help me understand.
Yeah, sure.
That
are you some kind of practicing Christian at the moment?
Well, we're all failed Christians. I believe that Christ is the Son of God. I believe
if you don't mind my asking, what tradition did you grow up in?
I grew up Catholic.
Oh, you grew up Catholic. Okay, all right. That's interesting. Because if you'd run up Protestant, I had some specific things to say about Protestant doctrine regarding the possibility of infallibility in certain cases, but that doesn't apply to you, so I won't go there. Well, do you think that it is in principle possible for someone to know, maybe not everything infallibly, but to know something with infallible certitude, like, say, the principles of arithmetic, for example?
That's independent of the Pope.
I'm just asking if it's in principle possible.
So we can't follow that logic to saying that sometimes he's fallible, sometimes he's not.
That's absolutely to the point. That's absolutely to the point, right?
And help me understand it, because...
Yeah. I'm trying to get there. Bear with me, okay? All right. But my first question was, do you think it is principle impossible? I mean, is it possible in principle that a person could have could be infallibly certain of at least something, like, say, for example, the principles of arithmetic? Now, a guy could be infallibly certain of arithmetic, but be fallible with regard to everything else, but he's not going to make a mistake when it comes to arithmetic. Do you think that's, like, even theoretically possible?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what the Catholic Church holds about the Pope is very something, it's analogous to that. Namely, the Church has never said that the Pope is always infallible under every circumstance. There's a very restricted set of circumstances under which the Pope is infallible, and infallible means he's not going to make a mistake in this restricted domain. Now, so it's really a question of defining what we mean by infallibility, and then why we think that's taught in sacred scripture and what's necessary for the constitution of the Church. So what does infallibility mean? It means that under a restricted set of circumstances, when the Pope pronounces on a matter of Catholic faith or practice that's essential to Christian identity, that he won't be wrong. It doesn't mean he won't be foolish. It doesn't mean he won't be, let's say, infelicitous. It doesn't mean he won't be imprudent, okay? And think about all the true things you could say that would be better left unsaid. Your great aunt asks you what you think of her new hat, you know, and you tell her truthfully, like, maybe you should have kept your mouth shut,
Yeah. Okay?
You know, a terrible hat, auntie, you know. And infallibility does not protect the Pope from making mistakes of that kind, all right? And I'll give you a classic example. The First Vatican Council defined a dogma to be infallibly true that one of the Church's leading theologians and saints of the Catholic Church, John Henry Newman, thought, you know, I don't object to the concept that the doctrine is true. I object that the Church defined it. I think defining it was a bad thing to do. It was infelicitous. It was imprudent. It was the wrong time. It's a truth that could have been left unsaid. Now, whether Newman was right or wrong, my point is that Newman's position is intelligible. It makes sense within the Catholic framework for someone to say of the Pope, what he said was true, but he shouldn't have said it. So there was a mistake, and I put that in quotes, in terms of his prudence or his timing or his wording, but the proposition itself is not false. Right? So that's a pretty restricted domain. The Pope is not infallible. In other words, there's no guarantee that he'll even speak true propositions unless the Pope's specific intent is to define a dogma of the faith, that is to say, something that is essential to the deposit of faith as revealed by God. And so, you know, classic examples of dogmas would be things like the dogma of the Blessed Trinity, or the dogma of the two natures of Christ, or the dogma of transubstantiation. If the Pope pronounces on a topic like this and says, this is something that is of the essence of Christian faith and Christians must believe it, then he at least is not going to be mistaken in the proposition that he pronounces. But if he doesn't intend to find a dogma, if he's just giving out his opinions, or if he's talking about any other kind of subject matter, then he is as prone to error as any other human being, right? And you're not obligated to hold with the assent of faith anything that he says. The number of times in history that a pope has actually pronounced thus is very small, a finite number of times.
Pretty rare.
And it's,
yeah,
and it's these kinds of issues, right, that are at issue. Now, in terms of why is this necessary? Well, sacred scripture tells us that that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church that's founded upon the rock of St. Peter. And whatever the church binds on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever loosed on earth will be loosed in heaven. Whoever hears the church hears Christ. All that's Jesus' promise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the necessity of that is that if Christ tells us whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, then the believer has to have certainty about the content of the deposit of faith that he is to believe. And imagine if I said, well, you know, believe all those true things about Christ. You know, whatever's true of Christ, believe it. Okay, so Anders, what's true about Christ? Well, I'm not really sure. You know, there's some true things in there. I can't tell you with certainty which ones are true. But whatever they are, you have to believe them. If they're not true, you don't have to believe them. But if they are, you have to believe them. What? Well, you can't make an act of faith that way.
No,
you
got
to
no.
be able to define the determinate content of,
sure.
of the faith, right?
Yeah.
And so that's when Christ gives to Peter this charge. Implied within that is the promise that if Peter acts in that capacity, he's not going to be wrong.
We hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your call today. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Lines are very busy on Fridays, so my personal recommendation here is call early, 833-288-3986. David's listening to us in Peoria on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, David. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you. I was having a very pleasant discussion with a friend of mine yesterday concerning the early church and St. Augustine. And I was a little surprised that he asked me, the question was, he was a bit surprised that Augustine had been made a saint by the church, because he, according to research that he had done, perhaps later in his life, he had somewhat maybe reverted back to Gnosticism or Manichaeism, and I said I don't know about that, but I know someone who probably does.
Yeah.
So that's my question.
Yes, okay. Thank you. I really appreciate the question. So that is an old canard in anti-Catholic polemics, right? A baseless rumor or story with respect to the life of St. Augustine. I understand why people say that, but they say it most injudiciously, right? So let me give the scoop on St. Augustine, what happened. Augustine was involved with the Manichaean cult when he was a young man before he became Catholic. And you know, there were a lot of things about Manichaeism. Basically, Manichaeans were dualistic in their view of reality. They weren't strictly Gnostics. They were materialists that thought that matter was divided into two sorts. There was a kind of coarse matter and a sort of fine matter, and that the soul of humans was of the finer variety, and that the world around us was of the more coarse variety, and that salvation consisted in identifying with the finer sort and liberating it from its imprisonment within the coarser variety. And they advocated such arcane rites as trying to free captured spirits from vegetable produce, actually.
What?
Right? Yes, so precisely. And so they had their community was also divided into two. They had the elect and the hearers. And part of the job of the hearers was to bring offerings of fruit to the elect, and the elect would eat the fruit and thereby liberate souls that were trapped in produce.
Wow!
Right? Yeah, I mean it's that's completely crazy. It's slightly less crazy than you might think when you come to understand that actually the belief that souls could be entrapped in vegetable matter was actually more widespread in antiquity than you might think.
Really?
Pythagoras thought that that there were souls trapped in beans, for example, which had something to do with beans' digestive effects upon the human person, right?
Okay.
And why he forbade his followers from eating beans, lest they liberate souls, right?
Just so, when I thought, right, I thought I had heard it all.
Exactly. So it's bizarre stuff, but this was kind of floating around there in the
sure.
ancient world, right? So they had these kind of beliefs. They were also determinists, right? Because if you're a materialist, it's hard to avoid the conclusion of determinism. And they thought that the sort of the divided mind, that is the lot of every human being, you know, we're kind of divided against ourselves, was a function of the sort of the battle between these two kinds of matter, the coarser and the finer, so forth, and that locked in this battle between two wills, we were sort of the victims of our lot, and we couldn't really do anything about it. And they also claimed that their position was sort of perfectly rationalistic and could be demonstrated with infallible certainty, right? All of these are positions that St. Augustine would eventually turn against. They're all positions that he would eventually turn against. And what gave him wings, as he put it, to abandon Manichaeism and eventually become Catholic was, first of all, the discovery of Neoplatonism and the idea of immaterial reality, that not all reality was matter, that there was an immaterial variety. And that the intelligible realm was identified with the immaterial, and that the soul could ascend through intelligible species like Plato taught or Plotinus, so that he eliminated the materialism. He also came to believe very strongly in the liberty of the will, the freedom to choose, and he had any number of treatises on the doctrine of free will against the Manichaeans. He rejected the doctrine of the two souls. He actually had a treatise by that title, Against the Two Souls, or On Two Souls Against the Manichaeans, right? So pretty much every sort of metaphysical theory that the Manichaeans produced, he also rejected rationalism. He realized that Manichaeism could not be rationally demonstrated, nor could it be squared with empirical science. That was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for him. And he evolved a much more subtle understanding of the relationship between faith and reason. So on all of these basic points of Manichaean doctrine, he rejected Manichaeism and he never went back, right? Now, the reason that some people falsely attribute a kind of reversion to Manichaeism in Augustine is that late in his life he got involved in a controversy called the Pelagian controversy about the relationship of grace to free will. And Pelagius's understanding was that grace is basically moral suasion, that, you know, sort of the admonition of the Ten Commandments and the teaching of Christ moves us, and then we freely choose to follow them. And Augustine thought that we needed more vigorous help from the Holy Spirit, that without grace we really kind of were trapped in sin, not because we had two wills, but we had one will, and one will that was pretty infallibly settled in on its attachment to matter and inordinate desire, and that we needed to be liberated by Christ from that inordinate desire. And so, you know, that's where people get the idea that Augustine was a determinist, because he would say, well, without grace, you're doomed to sin. Your freedom only serves to bring you deeper and deeper into sin. You need to have liberation from the Spirit of Christ. But the whole point of grace, according to Augustine's teaching, is that it in fact liberates, right? So the idea that we're still locked in this sort of Manichaean dualism is false. And Augustine thought that striving for moral perfection was a very reasonable aspiration for Christians in the domain of grace. So that's the story. That's why people think that Augustine had some sort of reversion to Manichaeism, but he never left off condemning Manichaeism and rejecting all of its major philosophical theses. But he did have a stronger doctrine of sin and of the effects of sin on the human will than, say, some of his other Christian contemporaries who would have overstressed free will as if and one thing that I think Augustine's been sort of vindicated by cognitive science and neuroscience in the 20th century. We now know that acts of the will by themselves are rather impotent to bring change. Like, if you get into, say, addiction recovery, they'll tell you, like, willpower alone is not how you get this done.
Yeah. Hey, David, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks for checking in from Peoria. In a moment, we'll talk with Mary in Fairfield, Connecticut, Steve in Middletown, New York, Lou in St. Louis, and a couple lines open for you. Last chance for you, 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. Do give us a call if you've got a question for Dr. David Anders, or maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. We took one of those calls earlier in the hour, said the caller said, well, this is what's keeping me from becoming a Catholic. Well, why don't you tell us what's stopping you from taking that step across the one-yard line there? 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Meanwhile, let us raise a cheer for a wonderful milestone. We are celebrating 10 amazing years with one of our great EWTN radio partners, KSWZ 105.3. They call themselves the Sword of St. George, broadcasting to St. George and Manhattan, Kansas. They have been a vital voice for faith in their community. Our warmest congratulations going out to Ken Hampton, Lee Deffendorf, and then the entire team there at the Sword of St. George. Thank you so much for a decade of partnership for your friends here at EWTN. All right, back to it for Steve now in Middletown, New York, listening to us on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today, sir?
Quick question. It has to do with Ephesians 6, that famous whole armor of God chapter. It ends with, specifically, I got confused when it came to 6:12. We are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies. I got that. But against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world. Got that. Against mighty powers in this dark world. I got that. And here's my confusion. And against evil spirits in the heavenly places. I looked at a whole bunch of different versions. They all seem to agree. Evil spirits in the heavenly places, and I'm going like, what evil spirits are in the heavenly places, for goodness sakes?
Yeah,
that's
thanks.
My question.
Yeah,
okay.
I appreciate it. So if you look back at Ephesians chapter 2, you'll see that Paul says, you previously walked according to the ways of this world, according to the ruler of the power of the air, the spirit now working in the disobedient. And so it seems to be the cosmology of Ephesians is that the apostle envisions the demonic realm as incorporating, the upper atmosphere, basically, is the way he's borrowing a trope from what was probably common among Jewish cosmology at the time, you know. So
okay.
You can find passages of the Old Testament that I think we have to take clearly figuratively that refer back to the firmament, you know, when God creates the heaven and the earth and they're separated from the earth by the firmament.
Yeah,
the firmament
yeah.
is literally a glass dome that was thought by the ancients to encircle the earth. And in Ezekiel has a vision. He looks up at the heavens and he actually sees the underside of God's throne situated on the other side of the dome, right?
Wow.
And again, this is clearly figurative representation,
sure.
right? But the cosmological vision of the time was a geocentric earth, and at the sort of the far extremes of the cosmos, on the other side of the dome would have been the dwelling of God and the saints and the angels, and then lower down from that you would have had the exiled spirits, the malevolent spirits, whose realm was the air, i.e. the heavenly places, because heavenly places here doesn't refer to the abode of God and the saints, but the upper atmosphere, basically.
Okay. Steve, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, that is. Did you think that Paul wrote Ephesians? There was some scholarship that said it wasn't one of the ones that you could absolutely attribute to Paul.
Right. So virtually all modern critical Pauline scholars doubt the Pauline authorship of Ephesians and Colossians and the pastoral epistles, right? So they are not among the undisputed letters of Paul. For purposes of this show, I refer to the Apostle Paul because that's the canonical understanding, and the text self-identifies as being from Paul. You know, critical scholars have good reason to doubt that. You know, the way a Catholic who wants to be faithful to the tradition but also not turn off his brain and still pay attention to critical scholarship would function is to say, well, you know, this is written sort of in the style of Paul or inspired by Paul or by a Pauline disciple or this kind of thing. So it's sort of in the vein of the Apostle Paul, but there are significant differences.
Steve,
for what have been identified as the authentic Pauline letters.
Steve, thanks so much for your call from Middletown, New York. I wonder how many Middletowns there are in America. We should research that. It's like Springfield. It's one of those names that just keeps popping up. Here is Lou now in St. Louis, listening on the Great Covenant Radio Network. Hey, Lou, what's on your mind today, sir?
Greetings. Thank you for speaking with me again. Super abundant blessings to all of you there and all listeners. My question has to do with a statement I heard recently that a bishop made, that marriage of a Catholic to a non-Catholic is forbidden by canon law, but that dispensations are routinely made. Now, if those two statements are factual, why even have that law?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So it is true that for a Catholic to marry a non-Catholic in the Catholic Church, one must receive a dispensation from one's bishop. It is also true that if one asks for the dispensation, one is almost always likely to get it. All right. So why have the rule? And that was your question. To make people pause. So they pause and give it
slow
some thought,
them down a little
right?
bit.
You know,
yeah.
So you know, usually by the time you get to the stage of asking for the bishop's permission, like, you know, you're hopelessly head over heels at that point. Like it's done. It's a done deal, right? But if you're aware of this, you know, then maybe that it will give you some thought before you go out dating and looking for a spouse. Maybe I should confine myself to the household of faith and other Catholics, you know. And why is this a good idea? Well, you know, when you marriage is for the procreation of children and for raising them up in the faith. And so when you have kids, if you don't have a Catholic spouse, you're going to have some kind of, maybe not open conflict, but at very least, you know, you're not going to be of one mind entirely how the kids are to be raised. And you're not going to be united in the faith and the practice of faith for the sake of the children. And since that's one of the principal ends of marriage, is to have kids and to raise them as Catholics, if you don't have a Catholic spouse, that's rendered all that much more difficult. So you ought to give some thought to it before you go marrying a non-Catholic. But, you know, if you have to, you have to, and the church will dispense you from that obligation.
Lou, thanks so much for your call from St. Louis. Our producer, Ace McKay, did a little quick research here, found that there were 25 cities in America named Middletown. 25.
How about that?
Yeah, and Springfield, I believe the number I heard was 33, but that may or may not be accurate. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Still time for your call, 833-288-3986. Let's go to Mary now in Fairfield, Connecticut, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hi, Mary. What's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon, Dr. Anders. Thank you so much. Taking my call, and I am in a position where I need some help in conception, as the beginning of life. And so, in my teaching, I need this help. So I'm calling you to see to get some.
Yeah, sure. So you faded out on us a good bit there when you were talking, but I think you were asking for literature that would define life as beginning at conception. Is that, did I understand you correctly?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, do you need theological literature or embryological literature?
I wouldn't mind the other, actually, too.
Okay. I can help you on the theological literature. I can't do much for you on embryology because I'm not an embryologist and I don't have the scientific bibliography at my fingertips. But probably the most prominent resource recent text from the Catholic Magisterium that infallibly defines life as beginning at conception would be Pope John Paul II's encyclical Evangelium Vitae. Also, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Both of them would affirm that teaching. I mean, it's presupposed in all Catholic moral theology about the beginning of life. Mm-hmm. But those would be two places where you'd find it explicitly.
Well, there you go, Mary. Thanks so much for your call today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. A question here from Todd: is it okay to consider that the Great Flood was brought about by the end of the last ice age, thus fitting many of the world's cultures' takes on flood legends?
Yeah, thanks. So the way a Catholic reads the Bible is principally with an eye to the spiritual sense of the Scriptures. And that means reading the Bible in a way that helps me connect to God and to grow in the likeness of Jesus. It's reading all of the Scriptures with the centrality of Christ in mind, with the mind of the church under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. That's the spiritual sense of the Bible. The literal sense on which the spiritual sense builds is what is it that the sacred author had in mind? And the two are not in conflict, but they sometimes can be divergent, right? If I go back and look at the flood story in Genesis 6, and I say, what did the sacred author have in mind? One thing that seems fairly evident to me, at any rate, is that the sacred author was not trying to write a chapter in a textbook of modern geology. That was not his intent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's making a moral point about humanity's relationship to God. And then spiritually, the New Testament reads it as an allegory for Christian baptism. Not the washing of the unrighteous from the face of the earth, but the cleansing of sin from the soul. That's the way the New Testament reads the passage.
Okay.
If I investigate a completely unrelated topic, which is what does geology have to say about the history of the earth, say 6,000 years ago, and I'm no geologist. I did in fact take one course in geology in college that I took to fulfill a natural lab science requirement for an otherwise liberal arts major. I enjoyed it, but I claim no expertise in geology. But my sense is that modern geologists do not find evidence for a worldwide flood 6,000 years ago, not anywhere close to that. There is, as you mentioned, there are flood narratives that circulated in the ancient Near East, in particular Canaan and Mesopotamia. Was there some historical flood that was local to those regions that stands at the root of those flood legends? Could be.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not a geologist. I rather think the end of the last ice age was a lot longer ago than that, you know? And so I don't, to me, it doesn't seem plausible that those cultures would construct those narratives based on a geological event that would have been like impossibly ancient relative to their point of view. If you could find geological or ethnographic evidence of that, there's nothing preventing you from engaging in that kind of investigation.
Well, there you go. Todd, thanks so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We can get a few more calls in at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Boy, have we got something great for you on EWTN's Podcast Central. It is real talk all about family life when you check out the Dr. Ray podcast. Now, this is not the regular Monday through Friday call-in show. This is something that is special just for you, where Dr. Ray Guarendi offers straightforward, often funny advice on everything from parenting struggles to personal and professional challenges. You can find this and other great-filled podcasts at EWTN.com/radio. Once you're there, click on the words Podcast Central. That will take you to not only the Dr. Ray podcast, but all kinds of fantastic podcasts, over 100 of them for you to check out. EWTN.com/radio, and then click on Podcast Central. We'll get back to the phones in a second here. Interesting question from Roger that I don't believe we've ever heard in our 10 years of doing this show, David. Roger says, in the Gospels, there are times when the words of Jesus were left untranslated. Why would this be?
Usually if he was speaking Aramaic.
Yeah.
Because the New Testament is written in Greek.
Right.
And if there are passages that are in Aramaic that the Greek writers left in Aramaic, it seems that they're quoting something from the oral tradition handed down about Christ, and they're just taking it verbatim and sticking it in there, right? And we do this in English. There are expressions that have become colloquial in English that are actually foreign expressions. I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. Something like, vive le roi, or...
C'est la vie.
There you go. I couldn't think of it. C'est la vie. Exactly. Good example. Why don't we translate c'est la vie? Well, it wouldn't be c'est la vie then. Now,
well, that's right. True.
Exactly.
That's true. All right. There you go. Roger, thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from Jeremy. What is the difference between confidence and pride?
Yeah. So pride is an immoderate assessment of one's own importance and value. you know, often proceeds from a deep sense of insecurity, like, you know, one wants to feel important, and so one insists immoderately upon one's importance, you know, beyond what's reasonable, and often goes hand in hand with jealousy and kind of a hatred of the elevation of the other, and mm-hmm. and you know, somebody else's. I remember once when I was in high school, I was a rather mediocre guitarist. There was another fellow who was also a rather mediocre guitarist, but he was better than I was. And he got picked to play in a school production, and I didn't even audition for it because I hadn't been asked, and I was kind of like grumble, you know, and I remember like kind of wanting to put the guy down, you know, because justice demanded that he get the part, not me, right? But yeah. Pride and jealousy made me want to elevate myself beyond what my natural talents would have sustained, right? Mm. To see him, you know, taken down a peg. That's pride, right? Now, if I'd actually been asked to sit down and play the sheet music, confidence would have been lacking. You know, confidence. Yeah. Confidence is you know, knowledge of one's competence, you know, based on experience, and is a necessity for really accomplishing any task well. I remember when I was teaching one of my youngest kids to play the piano, something else at which I'm not expert, by the way, we would... We had the same problem every time we'd introduce a new piece. You know, I was trying to sort of gradually move him from easier pieces to harder pieces. Uh-huh. And he would have memorized, you know, the previous piece and gotten it down perfectly. And then I'd put a new piece in front of him, and he'd take one look at the first measure and go, "Oh, that's way too difficult. I can't possibly do that." And I would say, now, remember you said that the last time. Let's take it one note at a time, one measure at a time. Oh, I can't. It's horrible. It's terrible. It's way too hard. I can't possibly do it. Okay. Just play one note, right? Now play two notes, now play three. Doing it that way, we got the first measure down, the second measure down, then before long, he was confidently diving into doing all of them.
My wonderful wife likes to say, how do you eat an elephant?
He's one bite at a time.
One bite at a time. Here is Elijah in Fairfax, Virginia, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Hey, Elijah, what's on your mind today?
Hi. So I was baptized and chrismated in the Greek Orthodox Church, but my family goes to a Roman Catholic church. My wife is Roman Catholic, and I have so I've been partaking in communion, also in the sacrament of confession at a Roman Rite parish, and I was just wondering something. I think I was listening to actually Dr. Anders. Some weeks ago, and it made me think that maybe I was not doing the right thing, that was not appropriate. And so I was just hoping to get some insight into...
Sure.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Code of Canon Law states explicitly that the Catholic Church does not object to members of the Eastern Churches partaking of the sacraments of confession and Holy Communion in the Catholic Church, but does urge separated brethren to, you know, follow the canons of their own tradition and the guidance of their own bishops. And so from the point of view of the Catholic Church, this is not objectionable. It might be objectionable from the point of view of your Greek Orthodox bishop. In fact, I'm almost certain that he would not be happy about that, right?
No.
But from our point of view, yeah, I mean, we're like, come on in. You know, we're, you know, your family. I know other Eastern Orthodox Christians. I know Palestinian Orthodox, for example, that regularly come and partake in Catholic liturgical practices and so forth. And their attitude is, you know, we all want to be one, and Bishop Schmishop, that's kind of how they think about it, you know, okay. on their side, like not for our side.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But again, you know, I don't want to invite controversy and problems with the Eastern Orthodox side of your life. So, you know, you know, a question I might, this is rhetorical and you don't have to answer it on the air, but if you are partaking of Catholic rites and you feel comfortable doing that, and, you know, you don't regard the Catholic Church as the Whore of Babylon and the Antichrist, as some Orthodox do, you know, the question that I always put on this show is, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Yeah.
You know, typically, the way the Catholic Church views this is that as an Eastern Orthodox Christian, your, you know, your natural home would be in union with the Church of Rome as an Eastern Rite Catholic, and there are Greek Catholic churches, and you know, there's very little distance there between where you are as a Greek Orthodox Christian and where you would be as a Greek Catholic Christian. Basically, nothing more than a profession of faith, and then there you are, you know. And so you just think about that, but that's for another time.
Absolutely, Elijah. Take that to prayer, if you would. And thank you so much for your call from Fairfax, Virginia. Let's go back to an email from Janice. Protestants have told me that All Souls Day and All Saints Day, both of those are pagan holidays. How can I respond to this?
No, they're not. Find me one pagan that celebrates them. Do I know? I don't know any pagans that celebrate that venerate all the Catholic saints on a special day. I don't know any pagans that have as part of their rites to pray the suffering souls out of purgatory. And these are really, really Catholic feasts that presuppose a Catholic vision of reality, a Catholic vision of salvation, a Catholic vision of eschatology. They most certainly don't have pagan origins. They have Christian origins. They didn't do them in ancient Greece. They didn't do them in Indochina. You know, you're not going to find them in ancient Canaan. I mean, they didn't do them in Mesoamerica. I mean, I'm looking at all these sort of classic pagan cultures, and they don't have the Feast of All Saints. They don't have the Feast of All Souls. They didn't come from those cultures. They came from Catholic culture.
Seems pretty settled to me.
Yep.
Thanks so much for your email, Janice. Gloria offers up this one. If you were baptized Catholic but left the church because of poor catechism, who is at fault?
Oh, your catechist. In my judgment, your catechist is at fault, not you. Yeah, I mean, you can only act based on what you know.
Sure.
And you don't know what you don't know.
As the kids say these days.
You don't know what you don't know, right?
Yeah.
So you do the best you can. And if you're acting in good faith and following conscience, and, people say the craziest things. Catechists say the craziest things. Somebody gave you some really horrible catechesis and it told you something about the Catholic faith was just manifestly untrue. You have absolutely no reason to doubt. I mean, this person's been placed there in a position of authority. And you're going to take it at face value in good faith, as you should, right? And you don't know that you're being led astray. And then all you know is that, hey, this is just spiritually, this is not feeding my soul. I'm not growing in holiness or grace or self-knowledge or anything else. And here this other tradition seems to be meeting those needs, and off I go. I mean, it's a perfectly understandable direction for a person to go. And now if you know better, you come back.
There you go. Gloria, thanks so much for your email. Karen is listening to us in Salem, Oregon, on the Great Modern Day Radio. Karen, what's on your mind today?
I want to know if a person is baptized a Catholic because they started going to the Catholic Church with someone else and they became enchanted by the beauty of the church and everything. And then they told the priest, well, there was a lot of different things that the Catholic Church teaches that they did not believe. But the priest said, oh, that don't matter, as long as you love Jesus, and told them to go ahead and get baptized. They did, and later, way late in their life, decided that they just didn't believe those things, and they joined a Protestant church that follows Jesus and God and the Bible. And they're being told now that they're going to hell and that there's no salvation for them because they left the Catholic Church and all that. What is your take on that?
Okay, all right. Well, first of all, the priest shouldn't have told them that it didn't matter whether they agreed with the Catholic faith, that he was wrong to do that. And if you join the Catholic Church, you ought to join the Catholic Church because you believe the Catholic faith, all right?
Yeah.
Now, from a theological, canonical point of view, their baptism as a Catholic was valid, but unfruitful, right? Because it's one thing to have a valid sacrament. It's another thing for the grace to be fruitfully applied to your soul. The valid sacrament makes it available to you, right? But you got to cooperate with it to grow in it. And if you don't have faith and charity towards God, you're not going to grow in the graces as they are communicated to you. Now, if they were to come back to the Catholic Church, they would not be baptized again. Like the grace of that sacrament would just be revived in them, mm-hmm. and they would be able to grow in grace and charity. Now, do I think that they're necessarily going to hell because they separated from the Catholic faith? No, I don't. Heresy is the obstinate denial of a truth of the Catholic faith, and they were never properly instructed in the Catholic faith to begin with, and it seems to me their their dissent was not obstinate in the aforementioned sense, right? It's like they were trying to operate in good faith and conscience, and someone taught them badly about what their obligations were as Catholics.
Karen, I'm so glad we could get you in at the end of the show there. Thanks for listening to us in Salem. Dr. David Anders, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Hope everybody has a great weekend. We will see you again on Monday for another edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price. Have that great weekend. Get out there and enjoy it. And don't forget to come back on Monday. See you then. And until then, have a great day and a great weekend. God bless.